Okay.
Awesome.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of The Shit Show with J-Bo, and occasionally, The Shit Show really, really lives up to its name. Today's one of those days. But thank you, Forrest. You got your mic, Marco?
Yeah.
Thank you, Forrest, for telling me to, you know what, I guess I should have known, reset the router and modem, and I did, and it worked. Thank you, buddy.
I like how DIY this place is. First of all, this place is fucking cool, dude. I walked in
here.
You
were totally stoked. You've been taking pictures.
I've been taking pictures of the place. You know what it is? It has a community radio station feel to it, because
yes,
that's what it is.
Yes.
And that's kind of where I got my start. So walking into a place like this, you know, seeing where all the bands play. I know Calvin Johnson played in here.
I was at that show. It was actually Calvin Johnson.
Yeah.
He was with the Hive Dwellers.
Yeah, okay.
And then La Luz was that same bill.
Damn.
And
so
it was
you guys do shows. Yeah, not just, you don't absolutely just have bands in here to be on the radio. You throw shows in here and you broadcast the shows.
Absolutely.
Wow, that's sick.
Keep talking about that. I'm going to make sure levels are good.
Okay. Are we doing a level check live?
Are levels okay, guys? I'll get a text in a
second. That's awesome.
So Marco Collins, I've heard your name for a long time. I didn't know much about it other than, you know, okay, so there's a guy named David Meinert who owns the restaurant I work in, and you know, to tie this in with like the Beatles John Lennon thing, like, okay, so I'll get to that in a second. John Lennon claimed he was aware of his genius at a very early age, okay?
Right.
He knew he was different. Now, somebody referred to you as a genius for discovering talent, for hearing new stuff. Have you always felt different? Are you aware of your genius?
Yeah, my feeling different had something totally, it didn't have to do with talent.
Discovering talent.
Yeah, it was discovering my sexuality is what, like,
yes,
how I felt different growing up.
No shit.
Yeah, I always knew that I was different. I always knew that I didn't fit in to the grand scheme of things, and that I was going to have to sort of forge my own path.
Did you feel like you're the only one?
In the town that I grew up in? Yeah. No, I'll tell you what. The first time I saw gay people, yeah, this was tough for me, because as a kid, I mean, I grew up with a dad that was a cop, you know, so Irish macho cop. There wasn't a lot of room for, you know, stepping outside the boundaries in my home. Just, well,
whatnot.
No, not dresses. I never really wore dresses. I just, you know, I remember, like, even when I decided I was becoming punk rock and cutting my hair and bleaching my hair, that shit was not acceptable in 1982 in the home that I lived in or the town that I lived in. It was a very sort of, you know, stuck away in the mountains little town in Northern California, and anything different was not celebrated. It's changed quite a bit, but at that time, trying to do something different was challenged constantly. I remember my dad actually, when my dad divorced my mom, him coming over to the house to take my sister and myself out to lunch or dinner, and because I had bleached hair, he wouldn't take me with him. And I remember, like,
really?
Yeah,
bleach blonde hair.
Yeah,
I guess that would be bleach. Yeah,
yeah. It's it was just, you know what, my dad and I have reconciled over the years, but we've had a lot of friggin' differences, and it didn't make it easy growing up as a kid at all.
You said you knew something was different. You also told me earlier you had a girlfriend, so you delved into that.
Well, yeah, as a kid, I mean, you know, growing up, like, that's what you... Yeah, I had a girlfriend until my first year of college, and then I was like, fuck this. You need to figure... You know what's going on, you just haven't, like, tried it. Like, I knew I was gay long before I had ever had sex with a dude. So it's interesting, because now my little niece just came out, and she's 13, 12 or something like that.
She came out.
She came out of the closet.
Yes.
And it, for me, at first I was like, well, you know, how does she know unless, unless she's been with another girl. And then I'm like, no, dude, come on. Think about that. You knew long before you had ever been with somebody. You know, long before that, it was, you knew, I can remember memories of seeing, like, attractive men, which actually were boys at the time, yeah, on television. I must have been, like, I don't know how old, and I remember going, damn. But at that time, it wasn't a sexual thing. It was just, I remember seeing this kid on television, and I used to watch this show all the time, and I just remember, like, being so obsessed with him that I just wanted to be him.
Because who was this kid?
It was like this kid on this show called, now I'm really dating myself.
No, this,
it was a show called Nanny and the Professor. And it was like the son on, who was probably 10 years my elder. But I was just remember being very attracted to this kid. And that's my first memory of being, I guess, gay. It was.
You know, I had a similar memory. I didn't turn out gay. But I remember I was like 10, and I told the story. It's kind of funny. I was watching Magnum P.I.
Right.
And I remember
that mustache.
Being fascinated with Tom Cruise and like couldn't take my eyes off him.
Wait, Tom Cruise, sorry, Magnum P.I.?
Tom Selleck.
Right.
I'm sorry, Tom Selleck.
Okay.
and I just remember thinking, could I possibly be gay? I don't know. Like, could
oh,
I?
Oh, because you were super like drawn to Tom Selleck?
I forgot about it and realized I was into chicks, but at the time I didn't know, and I like start in my head about it, like, oh,
like am I gay? Be. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Tom Selleck, man.
That's funny. Yeah, it no, I mean, my first like knowledge in any way, shape, or form of gay people was sitting on the couch and
Jack Tripper pretending he was gay.
Right. No, it was the Gay Pride Parade happened in San Francisco, and the news showed clips of dykes on bikes and dudes with nun costumes on with face makeup.
And how old were you at this point?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know, 12, something like that.
So before this,
and I remember thinking, you're not like them. You can't be gay because that's who represents.
It was such an overblown representation.
Yeah, of course it was. Yeah. And, you know, I can remember, like, my family, you know, going, oh, shameful or, you know, whatever. Because that's what the news is drawn to. Like, you know, the most dramatic, the most over the top, you know, sensationalism. And I just, you know, I challenged it.
Stereotypes.
Yeah, exactly. And I challenged it just because I felt like there had to have been, you know, more gay people than that. But initially, I was kind of thinking, you know, you can't be one of them, you know. So you'd stick to girls and everything will change.
And was there a feeling of, because, you know, when I was like the Magnum P.I. thing, like I wasn't.
Dude, wasn't I love that it was Magnum P.I. with that big ass mustache.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe it was the stash you were attracted to.
Maybe. You know, I just, but it wasn't like, oh, maybe I could be gay, maybe I could be straight. It was more like, oh my God, what if I'm gay?
Right.
And that's, I think, with a young person back in the 80s or in obviously from the beginning of time before that, to have those thoughts, it wasn't like, oh, maybe this way or that. It was a negative thing. And that's got to be really tough for a child who feels like they might be the only one. Or nowadays, with hearing like Macklemore, like we talked about,
right,
that mainstream, you might think you're gay and may think, oh, maybe that's okay. And people are born how they're born. And I think that's a huge step, perhaps, at least in Seattle.
Well, that's why, you know, but I just went on a tirade about the Seattle Weekly cover because I think it's bullshit that, you know, Seattle Weekly did this article and called Macklemore a sellout on the cover of the magazine. I just, you know, to me, whether or not you like the dude's music, he is to be celebrated. Like, his success should be celebrated, you know? And, right, like, I've got to say, same love. And we were talking about this earlier. You said that to you, it was preaching to the choir a little bit. And maybe with a younger generation, but I feel like, right, you know, people that, lawmakers and, you know, mainstream America, and even, you know, fuck Australia and New Zealand, past.
Well, even the hip hop community. I mean, there is
exactly
a fair amount of homophobia in that thing.
Yeah.
and for Macklemore to come out, like, have you seen the comments? Because I have seen the comments on YouTube, not just for, like, homophobic, but just period. That's the unwashed masses, and it gets a little scary.
Oh, it does get scary. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, freaky.
Everything's, you know, that's gay, you know. I mean, a lot of the shit he said in that song, I just feel like that song, and I've said this a million times, is a civil rights anthem. And for somebody like me that was bullied and had to lie about who he was and had to, like, fake that he was somebody else for all these years, the shame that goes along with that,
yes,
can fuck you up, yes, as a kid. And so, like, I got into an argument with a young gay man about the importance of that song. And I just felt like, you know, dude, maybe you need to look out for more people than just yourself. Like, you know, you're thinking about the fact that his big issue is, how dare a straight man co-opt my sexuality? I don't need him to defend me. And my point was just the opposite. Fuck yes, you need him to defend you, because he's going to speak to people that are straight that you might not be able to communicate with. And maybe, you know, I know things have changed dramatically, but it's
not to everybody. Yeah, I mean
it is the fuck, man. The Midwest, you know, Georgia. Like, you know, I went to rehab in Georgia. I know what that place is like.
Rehab in Georgia. What?
Well, it was what the hell was
Atlanta, Athens?
No, it was not Athens. I flew into Athens, and hold on, I'll tell you. Statesboro, mm-hmm. Statesboro.
I've never been to state. I'm from Florida. I've never been to Statesboro.
Okay,
yeah.
I lived in Florida for a little while too.
Where?
Vero Beach.
Mm-hmm. Is that? Where is that?
It's north of Hollywood.
Okay. Is that on the west coast of Florida?
No, east coast.
East coast. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a trip. I lived there when I was 15, 16,
okay,
with my aunt and uncle for 3 months on a houseboat. Totally different experience. Saw Van Halen
for
the first time.
Was it good?
That was fucking amazing. David Lee Roth was still in the band.
Yeah, that's
cool. It was like the Women and Children first tour. That's how fucking old I am.
What is that, in the 70s?
No, 80s. So Women and Children first came out, I don't know, but it was early 80s.
Okay.
And yeah, it was an amazing time. I met this kid out there who had a motorbike, and all we did is cruise around the freeways on his motorbike, no helmets.
And people, like, drive really
barefoot.
Fast in Florida.
Oh, dude, especially on those, what do they call those things? The auto.
Absolutely.
Bond or the whatever.
I was going like 95 from Miami to St. Augustine a couple years ago, and people were blowing past me. It blew my mind.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's crazy. And we would take those things too. And he's like, oh, this is dangerous, but we're going to do it anyway. And you can't get off. Like, you have to go a long ways on those things. It's not like there's a million exits.
I'm guessing you were in the right lane the whole time.
Oh, fuck yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, two of us on a motorbike, and we
took 35 miles an hour.
Yeah. With this thing cranked all the way up. It was insane. We had a really good time. My aunt and uncle didn't know what hit them. I got away with murder. My parents never would have put up with all the shit that I got away with in Florida.
I did a bunch of shit as a teenager, and then all of a sudden I got arrested for something, like battering mailboxes. And
yes.
And a lady claimed I threw a bottle at her, which is total bullshit. And they thought, oh, it's time to lock Jesse down. That they didn't realize is, like, no, at that point, I was done because I just got busted. Like, I've been doing shit for years.
Right.
You know?
That's funny.
Yeah.
Everybody does that mailbox thing, right? Are you recording this, by the way?
Yeah.
Okay, Red.
And the levels are damn good. It's
good.
From what I hear.
Good.
Yeah. So Macklemore, this dude, it's doesn't it seem like, you know, people say there's something like a first world problem. Well, wouldn't that kid's argument be like a liberal world problem?
Exactly. And that was my like, total point, yeah, is, dude, you live in Washington and you're 19 or whatever. And so all you've known.
You should be so lucky to argue about this.
Yeah. I mean, all you've known is this super liberal, intelligent, mm-hmm, you know, community. Go outside this fucking place and look at some of the people out there. Yeah. It is not the case. So my point to him was,
very old
think
school
about, yeah, people other than yourself. Imagine a world that's not this fucking liberal, you know, right coast, I mean, left coast, rather, yeah. sort of, you know,
and then heaven. Talk about what kind of impact Macklemore may or may not make with right. that kind of song.
And that's my point. I'm not a huge fan of Dude's music, but I appreciate the fact that he challenged the system. I mean, what's more punk rock than putting out your own fucking record and going to, you know, and getting nominated for a fucking Grammy and selling that many records and actually hiring Warner Brothers rather than working for Warner Brothers.
Right, right, right.
You know, and that was kind of a big point of contention is that he
is not as
signed to Warner yeah. Brothers secretly. I had a friend that was trying to sign Macklemore. So I was hooking him up with a meeting with the guys, and he's kind of the CEO of a big label,
yeah.
a big major label, mm-hmm. and wanted to meet him. And literally, his best opportunity was going through me. And I'm like, dude, I'm not best friends with these
yeah.
guys.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
you know, I don't know them that well. But somehow, I was able to hook up a meeting okay. with them that didn't go so well. So my friend called me and said, "What the fuck? Macklemore just signed to Warner Brothers." Go look at Billboard magazine. It's all over Billboard. Like the name of the label has changed. And I'm like, wow, he might have signed under, you know, he might have actually signed to a major label and they're trying
but
to keep it on
exactly
the down low.
Like that?
No, it wasn't like that at all. What happened was he reached a point that he needed to utilize the machine. And so in a way, it's, you know, it's still stepping into a world that's not an independent world, but it's a very sort of punk rock thing to do, to actually hire these people to work for you and you're making the calls rather than them making the calls.
He clearly called the shots at that point. I didn't hear Macklemore, not even a note, until Thrift Shop.
Really? You had never even heard the old stuff on KXP or anywhere?
Never.
Wow.
Never. But I will say that when I was like, wait a second, Jack White played the WAMU Theater last year, and fucking this local rapper Macklemore's playing the WAMU Theater this year, and it's sold out. Who the fuck is this guy? Seven nights at the Showbox Market, sold
yeah.
out. I was like, I don't give a shit.
And now three Key Arena shows sold out.
That's crazy.
Tonight, tomorrow night, and the night after. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
That's why I was so pissed at the Weekly.
Okay, now the Weekly thing. I took the Weekly thing as you didn't read the article.
I flipped through the article, okay. and I understand what
really
the intent it. Was. I just think the cover's bullshit. Like, the cover says, if for somebody that's not going to sit down and read the article, that cover's a fucking, like, lame slap in the face. First of all, how do you sell out when nothing you've held on to every single artistic... It's not like Macklemore was putting out fucking Sgt. Pepper's for his first record. Right. Like, he's always been doing the same thing. It's not like all of a sudden on The Heist, he changed his artistic
Has
integrity.
Has it always been similar to this?
Yes, it's always been the same fucking thing, dude.
Okay.
And it's not like, it's not like he went any more pop. This was what he's always done. Now, I will say, he's a bit of an opportunist.
Sure.
You know, so he is able to jump on topics that are very popular at the perfect moment.
Thrift store shopping.
Well, fuck, that's always been popular. I mean, you know, it's just maybe not popular to the masses.
Exactly,
again, this is
exactly.
to the masses. You know, the same love thing, the timing was perfect. You know, whatever. The baseball, you know, he's really good. Mm-hmm. at embracing the flavor of the day.
And that Ryan Lewis, I appreciate with Macklemore the fact that in the name of the group, he included the producer.
Well, it's because Ryan, dude, Ryan's the secret weapon.
Well, all those producers with a lot of the hip-hop dudes / pop stars are the secret weapon, but they never can include it. But
right.
Macklemore went that step. It'd be like Timberlake or Justin Timberlake calling his record Justin Timberlake and Timberland.
Right.
He would never do that, but
right.
Macklemore did it. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, well, I guess Macklemore's sound changed pretty dramatically when Ryan and he hooked
when
up.
When was
that? I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. I'm not a huge
It wasn't just
aficionado. No, it was prior to this.
Okay.
Yeah, it was prior to this album. Yeah, just, you know what it is? I guess my biggest thing, and we kind of got into this earlier off air, but yeah. I just will not judge art on how many fucking records it sells or how popular it is. What?
One way or the other, whether it's 10 whether records, it's
shitty,
or
yeah. yeah. Just, you know, there's this whole I'm cooler than thou attitude that goes on in Seattle that just pisses me off. The rest of the world isn't like that. I guarantee you, if Macklemore was happening in San Diego, that city would fucking hold him up with high regard and celebrate him because it was bringing more attention to the city, more, you know, it would be a different thing, you know, and it just, like up here, it's, I don't know, man. Yes, the article, maybe the article tried to redeem itself by saying whatever, but the dude has a fucking price tag on his pants in the cover of the magazine. Just fuck you, Seattle Weekly.
Yeah, right on.
At a time I need support from them for these two acoustic Christmas shows I'm doing.
Those, dude.
I'm doing, so we're a girlfriend of mine and I, actually the producer on the movie. Her name is Michelle Quisenberry. She owns a restaurant called Volterra in Ballard and Kirkland.
The movie being The Glamour and the Squalor.
Yeah, exactly. See, I talk like everybody should just know about it.
I think a lot of people do.
Anyway, we just decided this space is empty. People rent this space, and it's a fucking cool little space right there in Ballard, yeah. Right next to the sunset and all that stuff. So I just was like, you know what? We did this benefit for the movie, The Glamour and the Squalor. Yeah. Yes. We did this benefit, and it was so much fun, dude. It
EMP,
was like,
right?
Yeah, EMP. It was a weird place to do it.
I think I played a show that night. I wanted to go, man. Somebody handed me a ticket to that thing.
Really? Yeah, shit. Oh, at the Five Point. Bought a bunch of tickets and gave them out to his employees. That's cool that he did that. Thank you, Dave. It was fun. It was weird, dude. Like, doing a show. That place is not a venue.
Was it in the Sky Church?
No, we did it upstairs in the cool little room that Sound Off always happens in.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So, vibe-wise, it was killer. I had P. Smoove. Do you know who P. Smoove is?
What's the name?
Yeah, so he's Peter Robinson. He is an MC for Fresh Espresso. He was in Mad Rad. And I'm missing one of his acts. Anyway, popular hip-hop here in Seattle. Yeah, yeah. He is an artist and does this crazy, cartoony, awesome art. And it's very identifiable, and his art's blowing the fuck up, dude. So I had him bring his artwork in to make it an art show because I didn't want it just to be a bunch of bands. I wanted it to be an experience. Mm-hmm. So it was rad, man. I mean, I've always had a very eclectic palette. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, why can't you put Nacho Picasso next to Mary Lambert? Yeah. Why can't you have those two people play in the same place?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it was a really...
That's great.
Yeah. Had Danny Bland there reading from his new book.
I interviewed Danny Bland.
Yeah, I love that guy.
Yeah, yeah. He's a nice guy.
It was a little challenging for Danny because...
He worked at the EMP.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
And it was a little challenging for him... Because everybody was drunk. There was tons of alcohol at our little party. Yeah. Everybody was drunk. So during his performance, it's not like the place got quiet and listened to him. The whole fucking room was talking. And I'm not going to like tell everybody to shut the fuck up. Yeah. Yeah, he's reading a chapter from the book. And I'm like, all right. So
first
you learned. No. I'm trying to remember what chapter it was. It was pretty fucking intense, though. I mean, it definitely changed the tone of the evening. But
the second chapter is like he wakes up. The character wakes up, and there's his blood on himself, and the woman's bloody, and she won't move. He thinks he killed her.
Right.
But then it turns out she was on her period. She's fucked up.
It's pretty gnarly, man. Yeah. But it bummed me out a little bit, but I wasn't about to go on mic and say, can you guys please shut the fuck up? Yeah. Like, all these people are there to support the movie. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so that kind of bummed me out. Crowds are so weird sometimes. Even when a crowd shows up, and I don't know if this is a Seattle-centric thing, but even when a crowd shows up to see a band and then they talk throughout the entire band set, like, I went and saw Cataldo the other night, who made one of the most brilliant albums of next year.
Cataldo.
And they're like people paid to get into Barboza to see them, you know? And so Barboza is packed. And like the whole back of the room is just talking like loudly. And I'm thinking, you had to have paid money. All these fuckers aren't here on a guest list. Mm-hmm. So these people paid $15 to $20 to come see this band and sit in the back of the room and talk. Now, I've been guilty of being in the back of the room and you see somebody you haven't seen in forever and you're trying to catch up. And sometimes it's not appropriate because there's a fucking band on stage. But I quickly...
It feels like a lot of those people were there to make the scene.
Maybe, but why pay that money? Like, go just hang out at Mobar, dude. You don't have to.
I saw the Duchess and Duke's last show, and they're one of my favorite Seattle bands of the last 10 years. And there was these people inappropriately dressed. And what I mean is like I don't know, just, you know, women dressed super sexy and like frat dudes walking around and just yapping up. I thought I heard these and saying like, oh, I heard these guys were good. And I literally had, shut the fuck up. I'm actually here to listen to it.
Yeah.
Don't make the scene. Maybe that's what's happening.
Maybe. And you know what? I've been guilty of that. I remember somebody at the Mary Lambert show. She's got strings up there. It's really like intense and sensitive. Yes, and I'm in the back of the room like going blah, 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 blah. And some girl actually flicked me on the shoulder and I was like, oh, like at first I was offended and I was like, fuck you. And then I was like, no, dude, there's a performer. These people came to see this person. Yeah. Take it out to the fucking, to the bar outside. Like, so I shut the fuck up.
I almost got beat up at the Paul McCartney show.
You did?
For telling two guys to keep it the fuck down.
Oh, you're a huge Beatles guy, huh? That's cool.
And they literally they're threatening to get me in a headlock, choke me out. They're right behind me, like a foot behind me. And I'm just sitting there like, these guys are going to make a move any second.
Wow. Were they just drunk? Alcohol makes people.
Over McCartney. And I was like, excuse me, I'm trying to watch this. Please. Like,
and you probably paid for that ticket, right?
No, I snuck in.
Okay. How'd you sneak in?
I hung out in the bathroom stall for 2.5 hours. I found an open door and walked in and found the first bathroom because I knew eventually somebody would ask me what was up. Sat on a toilet for 2.5 hours.
Shut up!
Until they opened up.
You did that?
I did, yeah.
You sat in a stall for 2.5 hours?
Yeah, from like 4 to 6.30, yeah. And the doors opened at 6.30.
So what were you doing in there?
Facebooking the whole affair.
Holy shit, that's so amazing.
And then, but get
this. You did that to see McCartney, dude? Oh, yeah. That's amazing to me. Respect.
Man. These dudes wanted to fight, and then all of a sudden, McCartney plays Let It Be. And we're all getting up, and this is about 2 or 3 songs after they wanted to go, you know. And then they tap me on the shoulder, turn around, and they're like, man, Let It Be, man. And they started hugging me. And now it was a big hug fest the rest of the show because McCartney was touching everybody. So
wow.
It was funny, though.
Wow. Yeah. Dude, I have so much respect for the fact that you were willing to sit in a fucking bathroom stall for 2.5 hours.
You're fucking Beatle, dude.
That's punk rock. Of course. That is fucking punk rock. I love that.
Yeah.
The only time I'm holding my tongue on that one. Holding my tongue. There's some stuff that's not appropriate even for the internet.
So I heard, Marco, that you were the first person to play Beck, Loser, or you played it a bunch or kind of like got that into the national consciousness. Same with Weezer. Is this true? Is this bullshit? Or how?
No, I mean, it's true. I mean, I think KCRW might have played it in Los Angeles, also a killer community station. KCRW might have gotten a hold of it about the same time.
Yeah.
A buddy of mine bought a 12-inch single. Beck had pressed up, or a label called Bongload had pressed up 500 copies of this vinyl, and my buddy bought it for me and sent it to me.
12-inch vinyl?
Yeah.
Cool.
He bought it to me and sent it to me because he knew that even though I was working at a commercial station that I played shit that wasn't necessarily commercial.
Was this the same version that went on Mellow Gold? Or a
version? Same exact version, dude.
Oh, okay.
Just mastered, you know. So
and he hadn't signed to DGC or whatever he was on.
No, not yet. In fact, DGC called me and they were like, hey, is this the real deal? And I'm like, it's the most requested song on the station. It's the
They're asking you advice.
Yeah, because I knew that whole crew. By that point,
yeah.
The Nirvana thing had been sealed. You know, I supported Sonic Youth. I supported Weezer. I supported Elastica. I supported all the band Jawbreaker. I played bands that were on that label that nobody played on the radio. Like Jawbreaker.
So you were in good with them.
Yeah, I was in good with them. So they knew me, you know, and Mark Cates called me and he was like, you know, is this the real deal up there? So when Beck signed to Geffen, they flew him up. I was like, can we do something? I know this isn't a part of his tour or a part of his plan because we're so early on this, but it's blowing up here. Can we get him up here to do a couple of shows? So Beck's first two shows in Seattle, I booked.
Okay Hotel
and The Crocodile. So I booked two. Wow. I booked one that was a 21 and up gig. And this is, you know, Susie Tennant worked for Geffen at the time. So it was kind of a, you know, we both worked on stuff like this.
Okay.
And it was a very interesting experience. The whole thing, like I remember, you know, and it's funny because different people remember it differently. Like if you talk to Chris Ballou, he'll tell you something completely different.
President of the United States.
Yeah. Okay. Talk to Mary Lou Lord, she'll say something different. What I remember is his DAT tape would not play properly with the beats behind it at the Crocodile. And all these people were used to this weird-ass song with beats, like almost a hip-hop-y weird. Like, that was not done at that time, right?
And he did it with an acoustic guitar.
With an acoustic guitar. Yeah. So, and but see, Beck was a busker. He was a Silver Lake kid that stood on the street and played, you know.
Of course.
So it was, he felt comfortable with that, and so he just played Loser sort of without the beats, or something happened, and people actually booed.
People didn't know what to...
Okay. The 21 and up crowd just did not react the way that I had hoped they would.
That was the OK Hotel?
No, that was Crocodile.
Okay, okay.
And then we did a matinee show the next day, and Chris Ballou ended up getting up with him on stage, and totally like did the human beatbox because he couldn't get this fucking machine to work or whatever it was. It was a DAT tape or it was a little program machine. And Chris Ballou got up there and, you know, just a younger generation embraces.
That's amazing.
Oh, it was amazing to watch because these kids went ape shit.
Yeah.
And Chris ended up tackling Beck on stage and they rolled around like it was total anarchy. It was exactly what you had hoped happened. And it was amazing. Yeah. So, yeah, we were, I mean, between us and KCRW in LA, we were the first to play. We were playing it on vinyl.
Was there a B-side?
Yeah, there was. My Body, I'm trying to remember, it was some wacky. I think we played it, though. After we had finished with that, we were like, this is blowing up. We need something else. I think we actually played the B-side for a while, too.
Is it Something My Body Home or something?
Yeah, I can't remember. Yeah, something about My Body, I think.
That's cool. Yeah, I have Stereopathetic Soul Manure on Bongload, and some of my favorite stuff. I feel like I loved Beck up until Midnight Vultures, and I liked a lot of his stuff after that, but that's when I kind of jumped off.
Like, yeah.
I loved his early stuff.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Odelay was fucking amazing.
Yeah, yeah. And Weezer?
Yeah, you know, here's the thing. Like,
I just read your wiki page. I thought it was interesting.
Yeah, you don't really know that you're the first to play something. Like, normally when you're given records at an alternative radio station, you're always the first to play something because who else wants to play brand new bands?
Like here at Hollow Earth.
Right, dude. Like, I'm sure you guys are breaking a lot of shit.
I play things that not only am I the first, but the only ever that probably will ever play.
Right. Right. Exactly. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what it should be. Yeah. You know, it's going to be interesting when you guys get your license because you've applied for one of those local licenses.
I think we'll get it, but, you know, who knows?
I think you're going to get it, too. I think you're an amazing candidate.
Yeah.
You've already got the digs, and I just wonder, is the station going to have to become a little more community oriented at that point?
How
to
do you
super
mean
serve? Well, like each of these little stations that are given licenses are given them for their town or their micro areas.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just wondering for the CD, Are you going to have to do a community talk show where so-and-so comes on and talks about, you know, public service announcements for the community?
That sounds like absolutely. A great idea.
Yeah. Why not?
You know, we do have, there's an emphasis on the Northwest.
Right.
You know, here at the station, for sure. That's very much emphasized. Wednesday nights, we do Central Sounds. And I don't know if they stick to it, but it was initially music that just kind of came out of this particular area.
Is that OC Note Show?
He shows up to that show a lot.
Okay.
Yeah. And I don't know if it's his show. I don't know if he has a show. He might.
Okay.
It's a guy named Jonathan and a guy named Rich Jensen.
Yeah. Rich Jensen? I know. Oh, yeah. Rick Jensen.
Or
Rich Jensen?
I think Rich Jensen. I think, yeah.
Rich Jensen that used to work at Sub Pop?
Yes. Yes.
Really?
Yes, yes.
He has a show here?
Yeah. He's,
fuck,
he's,
that's cool.
He's one half of the Central Sounds guys.
Wow.
On Wednesday nights.
God, that's amazing.
So there is
no
a lot
idea
of what you're talking about going
Rich
on.
Rich Jensen was a big deal at Sub Pop back in the day.
And he helped start up records, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So
he's in all the time, dude.
Wow.
Yeah.
Cool. I haven't seen him in a long time. Mm-hmm. He did a show with Charles Mouded. Is it Mouded? How do you say his name? From The Stranger.
Yeah, that's fine.
And
Mudetti.
Mudetti. I don't know how you say his name.
That
anyway,
guy lives on my street. He walks by my house every morning.
Does he? Where, do you live here?
I live in Columbia City.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Cool. I was going to ask you to give me a ride.
Where are you going?
This morning. No, this morning. Getting here.
Oh.
I took the bus here.
Oh,
yeah.
I don't
have
cars. You should ask me.
Yeah, that's all right. I live in Wallingford now, dude, which is the weirdest place to live in the world. I've been there like 6 months now.
I lived there for like 10 years near there.
In Wallingford?
Yeah. In like, it was actually like Tangletown, but it's roughly Wallingford.
Okay. Yeah, it's a weird place, dude. You walk down the street. It's just very white. Like, I like it a tiny bit more edgy. And trust me, I've already found the edge. Like, I found the edge, and I know the sort of the edgier.
Edgy in Wallingford. The Dick's parking lot at about 3 in the morning might get a little edgy.
Yeah.
Gasworks.
Like, you walk down the street, and people are actually talking about gluten-free. Like, you can hear people.
First world
in
problems.
Exactly. You can hear people in line at Molly Moon's talking about gluten-free, and I'm just like, ah! And, you know, I kind of was in that mode where I was like, you know, you could use a good family vibe right now in your life. This might be exactly what you need. Well, and, yeah, sort of take you out of danger zone. And it's...
Where were you living before, Marco?
Queen Anne.
Okay.
Which has gotten... Like, I'm going to say this and I'm going to sound like an idiot, but fucking Queen Anne has gotten edgy. Like...
Has it?
Oh, like
Aussies and shit like that?
Yeah, that whole area, dude, is I don't want to get into it, but it's it's edgy.
Oh, I'm sorry. I certainly would have given you a ride.
Oh, that's all right, man.
Okay, so you are a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I didn't know DJs.
Yeah, I mean, here's
representing Seattle.
Well, okay, so I just need to clarify this. So I am in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as a part of an exhibit. Oh, I haven't been inducted. I'm not Casey Kasem quality.
Okay.
But
is he inducted?
Yeah, Casey Kasem. Yeah, DJs are inducted.
They are.
But it's like Wolfman Jack. It's like soup. I'm sure Ryan Seacrest is in there. It's like majorly famous, insane DJs.
WKRP in Cincinnati.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. But this exhibit is there, and it's called On the Air. And so what it is a big exhibit that picks DJs around the country who have made a contribution to radio.
Yeah.
And so what you do is you've got to supply them with a 90-second clip of your life, of your radio shows, that will put your entire career into 90 seconds. And, dude, that was so much work
to get that done. Is that you just talking about it, or is it clips?
I made it a montage, because all I could figure is, if I'm a family and I'm at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, going through the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and my pants are unzipped. Whoops. I'm so glad it's radio. And I'm at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. What is going to make me stoked to hear on the, in this exhibit when I'm looking at this dude.
And what kind of things would you put in there?
I just put in interviews with every Seattle band that I had ever interviewed.
Did you interview a lot of them?
Yeah. Yeah.
I've heard of
I was there 8 years.
Good.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
You were where? At Candy D?
What'd you say?
You were there for 8 years where?
8 years at the end.
Oh, the end. Okay.
Yeah. So it, yeah, so I just, I made it a montage of some of the stuff that I was most proud of at the end. Some funny stuff. You know, it wasn't all Seattle bands.
What
the
are
Beastie
your highlights?
Boys.
Can you look back right now and tell me what may have made the tape, but just like personally?
Weezer playing the Sweater Song acoustic on the air.
Awesome. Good song.
What else? Chris Cornell playing Black Hole Sun acoustic.
Much better on acoustic than the recorded version, in my opinion.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Okay. I'm not a fan of the recorded version, but I have heard him play it. I thought, wow, those chords and that voice, beautiful.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. What else? The Beastie Boys doing a weird little grunge thing in the studio. A grunge rap. What else? What else is in there? Oh, my extensive conversations. Well, as extensive as I can get in 90 seconds with Courtney Love. One of which was her talking to me on the air after Kurt's death about Kurt. And it was a pretty intense conversation where she, you know, she's actually sane. I just wish she would have put that thing down and, you know, come shopping. Let's go shopping. You'll feel a lot better. Like, you know, referring to the gun that he killed himself
something
with.
So he could have talked him out of it, you know, and maybe he could have,
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, yeah, it's, you know, whatever. It was, so I put some of that in because some of my conversations with her, she would call my show and talk to me for hours, like, and just ramble. And the thing was, is that I remember my boss. I remember thinking, okay, you're totally breaking format. You're stopping all music and just talking for an hour.
To Courtney Love.
Yeah, it's going to flip him out, but you've got to do this anyway because this is groundbreaking fucking radio.
Of course.
You know, and it was at that time, and she had no filter at all. She would say anything.
I would love to interview Courtney.
Dude, I got her to tell me on
she
the air that she had slept with Trent Reznor and that he had a small dick. Like, she talked about that stuff on my show.
Nine Inch Nail my ass.
Exactly. That's exactly what she said.
I've heard that quote. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but that's what she said, you know, and like, so I was always able to get her to tell me exactly who she had been sleeping with. Like,
she made the rounds, right?
I mean, she definitely
settled on the king, the icon, the kingpin of the 90s.
Well, yeah, she, I mean, I think she messed up, she had relationships with a lot of different people.
That's,
Gavin, Billy,
Dave Perner.
Oh, did she and Dave go out?
Why would I know this?
Dude, Soul Asylum, that was the band that got lost in the 90s. I loved Soul Asylum.
Runaway Train was a bittersweet song. It was sad, kind of.
Yeah,
good song though.
Somebody to shove.
I wasn't crazy about that song.
God, I loved that song.
Oh, you did.
Yeah,
nice.
I loved Soul Asylum before, you know.
I heard
that record took them up, and then they just disappeared.
Where do you go from there?
Well, you put out another fucking record, and
change?
You keep.
I heard. Maybe I'm wrong, but I heard before that they were a little bit different, maybe more aggressive in punk. But then maybe they just couldn't repeat that kind of commercial
success.
Yeah,
but I mean, but who isn't? Like, when you sign a major label deal, and this is why, this goes back to my argument that I don't care how many records you've sold. If the record is good, then I'm in. Like, I have to tell you that I enjoy some of the best records ever are major label debuts. And the reason that they end up being groundbreaking is it forces you to look at your art and dig in and rewrite that song and work on that song. It forces you to embrace your work and take it very seriously. And that's why, you know, Sonic Youth's Goo is so genius. It was their first record on a major label, and the record is clean. You know, it just sounds good. You know, Nirvana's Bleach. Nirvana's Nevermind. Another record that fits that mold.
Absolutely, they changed.
Yeah, but did they change? I mean, did they change because?
No. they did what they wanted to do.
Right.
But it's definitely, I mean, it's cleaned up. They had a different drummer, though. So, of course, they're going to change from Bleach to Nevermind.
Right.
I love, I mean, Nevermind's amazing. I mean, I don't think they compromised.
But no, but can you put out Bleach twice? Is the thing. At one point, if you're going to... No, you shouldn't. Exactly. You know what's funny about that is the fact that to a lot of people, In Utero holds up better than Nevermind.
To me, it does.
Yeah. Isn't that weird?
The reason why I think... I think there are some fairly weaker songs as far as Cobain goes on In Utero, but the production sounds like Nirvana live. Like I've listened to Live and Loud, and it's virtually indistinguishable between In Utero, the record, and what they played live. Nevermind, to me, sounds so much of the time. It's really produced and mastered.
Right.
Andy Wallace went in, and even produced it further than Butch Vig had, and made it so. It's an amazing record, but I think it's dated because of the sound, I guess.
Do you think it's dated because of the sound? Because I've heard people actually say that the drums and the production make it sound dated. I think that the oversaturation makes it sound dated. Like
everything about it.
I heard those songs so many fucking times. I had to play those songs so many friggin' times.
Oversaturation as in, I can't listen to Nevermind anymore.
Right. I can't
Radiohead's OK Computer, although they're great records.
Right.
I just
can't listen to them either. But the other day, I put on In Utero, and I was like,
In Utero kicks, dude.
And, you know, have you heard the Albini mixes? So he went back and...
Oh, no, I got the whole box set.
Yeah, wow.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's nice hearing some of those guitars sound so different. And I think a lot of Nirvana fans don't realize that in that box set... There's a new version of fucking In Utero that sounds very Ape, one of my favorite songs on that album, just because that guitar riff
comes
is
in earlier.
So... Yes, it does. Exactly. Guitar riff is so wiry and fucking aggressive. It's like a little angry midget.
Yeah.
Just like that's what it feels like to me. It's just wow, 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 wow. And then the rhythm is weird too. It's just sort of a weird rhythm.
The way the drums interact with
each other. Yeah. And so, I mean, but hearing that song on the Albini mixes, I just thought was, fuck, this is so worth it. This is like getting that album handed to me all over again.
Serve the Servants. I understand why they picked the lead guitar that they did, but it's really interesting hearing a different lead in there. More of a noisy, discordant thing.
Yeah.
And no cello on Dumb. I liked the cello, but it's once again, it's really cool.
Yeah.
It's fresh. You're right. It's like a new record.
Yeah. It's kind of cool to hear that.
I heard Chris Novoselic was actually inspired to do that from a Doors release that they did the same thing to.
Oh, really?
Yeah, some Doors record they came back and did alternate mixes and re-released.
Interesting.
And that's what was his idea.
Hmm.
So.
I was just thinking about Jim Morrison the other day, maybe even at 4 in the morning this morning when I couldn't get back to sleep, about how I think the Doors just get shafted. Like everybody, when you're looking at classic artists from the past,
right?
It's always Zeppelin. It's always fucking...
Fuck Zeppelin, man.
I mean, I just feel like the Doors, like, fuck, I loved them, man. I loved his whole... sort of dangerous thing. It's always Zeppelin, Stones, Who, the Beatles that get all the accolades, and people sort of shrug the Doors off as being like,
I agree.
You know, like
maybe that's because they're American. All those other bands are English. I don't know.
I have a feel. You know, I understand that Jim Morrison was a personality that was larger than life. I get that, and that might have dominated sort of.
You're saying maybe that took away from...
Well, maybe, yeah. I mean, it's all him, right? I mean, other than Ray Manzarek, there's sort of nothing identifiable about a Doors song. Now, I'm making a broad statement here.
The keyboards are a little bit...
That's what I mean, other than Ray Manzarek. Right, exactly. Like, he's a traditional sound for that band. Like, you know, those keyboards are identifiable. But, I mean, Jim Morrison's voice... was what carried that band.
Apparently his major influence was Frank Sinatra.
Wow.
Yeah, that was his main man as far as
influence
goes.
Yeah. I don't know. I hate to see him thrown into the disrespect pool. I don't know, man. I like the Doors a lot.
I think you're absolutely right, and we were touching upon this earlier. Intellectual elitism, you know, hipsters and this and that. As you know, where it's like, oh, we don't like this because it sold too many records. A lot of that is like, I consider myself very special, very unique, And if the mass is like this, well, fuck that. I'm not like them.
Right.
And so I'm a cut above. I'm going to go on to something different. It always was funny that nobody would recognize the Doors, but seems like every person wearing a black jacket in this town had a fucking Joy Division patch on.
Mm-hmm.
Ian Curtis was a huge Jim Morrison fan.
Like, was he? I didn't know that.
Absolutely. If you hear like Shadow Play, he actually like bites on Jim Morrison's style and some of his lyrics. It's really funny. And I thought that was funny. Like, you like Joy Division, you should probably check out the Doors, because
yeah, that's really funny.
They loved Jim Morrison.
That's kind of a trip. I had no idea. Ian Curtis, what a trip that dude must have been. God, I interviewed this. This was wild. One of my opportunities, one of my big interviews, actually happened at Live 105 in San Francisco. When
I went to the Green Christmas Ball real quick. Live 105. Best bang for my buck as far as a show goes. I saw Beck, Eels, Cake, Mazzy Star, Chemical Brothers, Republica, Fiona Apple, Allen Ginsberg.
Holy shit. That's for amazing. Throw Ginsberg into the mix.
For $10.
Jesus Christ.
Anyway, go on. Live
105. No, I was going to say I interviewed Peter Hook and Stephen Morris, drummer. Okay. Of Joy Division and New Order.
Oh, wow.
And it was like New Order was there. So I was interviewing New Order, but as soon as the New Order interview was done, I rolled tape and said, do you mind talking about Joy Division? And they both were like, no, go ahead. And I asked questions that nobody had asked them before, or they had refused to talk about, Ian. And literally it was Stephen Morris saying to me, you know, God, what was the quote? I might have included that in my Hall of Fame clip.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Oh no, it was Stephen Morris saying to me, you know, we were ready to go to America. It was going to be our first tour, and then Ian, it was, you know, a horrible time. His timing was just horrible. And he's like, not that there's ever a great time to kill yourself. And I'm just like, oh my God, this is heavy. Like, you know.
He was
just
like 21 years old, wasn't he?
I don't know, but what a definitive. I mean, if you think about Joy Division and New Order, like, it's all centered around, like, the instrumentation is all fucking, the identifiable is that Peter Hook fucking guitar sound, you know, and bass sound. That's identifiable sound.
Yes, yes.
And the Stephen Morris weird percussive dance sort of syncopated the way he plays. Uh-huh. And it was there as a part of Joy Division. It was there as a part of New Order. And I had the two guys, other than the voice and whatever, the guys that sort of created that definitive style. Mm-hmm. There, and they fucking were opening up, talking about a lot of shit. And I sat in this little, and it wasn't even in a main studio. It was in a little production studio, smaller than this room. And I'm like, I have two fucking legends right here. And they're talking about one of these moments in time that was like groundbreaking.
I love that. And you've seen it a lot more than I have, but I've been doing interviews for like a year now here. And I just love that feeling. I've been on the phone with people like Doug Marsh or Pete Best. And getting like the inside fucking scoop.
I love that you're doing this. Amazing. I love that you're reaching out. Because, dude, this whole thing is DIY. You got to make it happen for yourself. Because nobody else is going to look out for your show at all.
Yeah.
And it's kind of cool that you're reaching out to these people.
Mm-hmm. It's, I reached out to you, man.
I know.
Yeah.
I blew you off the first time. Sorry about that.
Oh,
I was not feeling well.
It was not the first or last time somebody.
And to be honest with you, this has got to change. But getting up at that time in the morning is just not something I do.
No, I can tell.
Yeah.
I can tell.
It's something that's difficult for me. But that's got to change because I need a real job.
You know what we're going to do, Mark? I'm going to play a couple songs and come back with you. Is that okay?
Awesome.
Cool. You're having a good time? You can stay for a
little bit? Yeah, absolutely.
Right. I am too, man. All right, guys. Marco Collins here on The Shit Show.
I love that your show's called The Shit Show, too.
Oftentimes, the best conversations happen off the air.
Yeah. By the way, one of my friends is listening and just commented on my Facebook.
Awesome.
What up, Gary?
Hey,
if you're still listening.
Thanks, Gary, for listening.
Gary said, it's really nice to wake up and hear you talking about attractive men, which means he was already listening.
Nice.
But there was not really something
in Paris.
Yeah, we were just talking about
that. You listening to Tomas from Daft Punk.
Yeah.
In the middle of a dance floor, sick as a dog.
Well, I became very obsessed with the whole French music scene. And to me, after I got tired of grunge and indie rock, I was looking for something else to not only play on the radio, but just something for me personally. And I had gone to raves here in Seattle in the mid-90s, but they always just seemed, it just seemed like a bunch of
dirty fucking hippies.
I embrace dirty fucking hippies. It just seemed like super young kids that were like, I just didn't identify with it, you know. And then I went to London and went to a Planet Dog party and just was there going, oh my god, this is, now I am totally connecting with this music. And I was in the middle of the dance floor with this girlfriend of mine, and we were just dancing our ass off. And like the artist that was on stage, I'm trying to remember who it was. It might have been Banco de Gaia. No, it wasn't Banco de Gaia. Who the fuck was it? I can't remember. But anyway, we're in the middle of the dance floor. It's packed. And he just like drops it hard. And I'm like, holy fuck. Like I'm just dancing my ass off in the middle of this club. And I'm thinking, this is the equivalent to being in the pit at a Nirvana show. It's the same feeling.
Yeah.
So it should work in the States. It's massive over in the UK. So I bought like a shitload of records and brought them back to play them on the end, and I got a lot of shit for it because people were saying I was trying to cram this electronic thing down people's throats. And then we flew the Prodigy over to play Enfest, and it, you know, did, you know, electronica didn't happen the way I thought it was going to happen with the Chemical Brothers and all these bands.
It started,
and now look at it. Like, now these artists are fucking massive, and it's awesome, man. And I think, so anyway, long story short, I got real obsessed with Daft Punk at that time. Homework had come out, and I just was obsessed with it. So I started digging around, and I started buying all the 12 inches on Tomas's label from Daft Punk. He had his own label. Roulet. And so I started buying all those 12 inches, and I memorized those songs. And I had already left the end, or it was my first year going to do A&R. So I was especially looking for something that could break in the States. So, so I went to,
what year was this?
It had to have been 98.
Okay. 98. Okay.
And 97, 98. And so a girlfriend of mine, she worked at Sub Pop. We went to Paris, and we actually went to London and Paris, and we it was a very fun time. But I got some fucking epidemic, and I didn't have insurance, and like the whole world was sick, so the hospitals were filled with people, and it was a really lame time because I wanted to be in Paris. We had all these things going on. The producer of Air was going to have us to the studio to hear his new record. Like, we were totally plugged into what was going on, and I was so fucking sick that I barely left the hotel, dude. And in Paris, it's not like you can go buy Theraflu in a drugstore. You can't go buy that shit. You have to get anything? It from a doctor.
Oh, really?
And so it was, I mean, that may have all changed now, but at the time, I couldn't buy something to just knock me out for 8 hours and let my body heal. And so it was just miserable, dude. I just sat in my hotel room throwing up, like, for days, covered in sweat. It was horrible.
That happened to me once in Puerto Rico. I had, okay, you know, I'd got some drugs.
Yeah.
From a taxi driver.
What drugs did you get?
Cocaine.
Okay.
Yeah. And I did some, man. And I was up all night. I was sick as a fucking dog the next day. I had like 2 days, 1 or 2 days in Puerto Rico where I was going to just, I was by myself, had this hotel room. I was going to explore. I had the heat cranked.
Oh, yeah.
Shivering under a blanket. And then the next day I had to fly the whole way back to Seattle from Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
It was horrible. I know the feeling.
Fuck, dude. It was so bad that, like, so first we were in England, and we were staying with Jim Reed from the Jesus and Mary chain. Okay. So he had a killer flat in Kentish Town. So we were staying with him, and it was like three stories. That was a whole different story. But it was, we had all these plans. We got tickets to see the Basement Jaxx play a club in London on fucking New Year's. Okay. And we were going to be in Paris for Christmas. But Christmas in Paris is gorgeous. Like, those people do it up. It's just, it's the most beautiful thing in the world. So we were going to go shopping in Paris and just have a great time. It was the most amazing trip. And then I was sick for half of it. Jesus. And I ended up, we came back from Paris, and I'll tell you more about the Paris trip. Came back from Paris. I had to sleep. I couldn't go out for New Year's. God, I wonder how much I can talk about without incriminating other people. So anyway, I...
When you want to censor yourself, just think about Courtney Love.
Right, she doesn't censor herself. Well, okay, so all I remember... Well, I remember a lot, but I was so sick at his place that literally I was sweating so bad that my t-shirt was drenched. I would take the t-shirt off and put it over the heater and let it dry and put on the t-shirt I had just taken off the heater. So I had two t-shirts. I just went back and forth.
That's really
as I sweated. Oh, dude, it was so bad. Shivering, sweating.
It's horrible.
For days.
It's horrible.
And then, of course, any city that I'm in, I know how to find the drugs quicker than anybody else. So they make me get up for New Year's and go out on the street and find drugs so they can party as I'm shivering.
From the drag queens?
Yeah, it was actually, it was during the day. So,
oh, okay, a different time.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, different time.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Ah, God, thinking about all that shit. But anyway, missed the Basement Jaxx, missed New Year's Eve.
Yeah. And you say that, it's funny. I was once in Miami for New Year's Eve.
Oh,
and
Jesus.
As sick as I've ever been, I just shivered on somebody's living room floor that I didn't know. There were no drugs involved this time. But I know exactly what you mean. So probably 2000.
Yeah.
New Year's. Yeah.
It's just, it's horrible. Up. Dude, you were in Miami in 2000?
I believe so.
So was I.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but that was a bad time.
Was it?
Yeah, really bad time. I'm not proud of that time at all in my life. That's not...
What was going on in 2000 with you, man?
I went to fucking rehab.
Is that the one in Georgia?
I left New York. No, I've been seven times.
Is that a nice place to go, rehab? Is it? I mean, obviously the circumstances in which you're going may not be ideal, but while you're there, is it decent? Is it?
I mean, it depends on what you. I don't know. Some are decent, some are intimidating, some don't let you read anything that's not God related. So really? you can't read a newspaper. You can't read any books other than propaganda from
Jesus.
From Jesus or propaganda from a 12-step program.
Do you think if you passed out Danny Bland's novel,
oh,
in case
Jesus
we died,
Christ,
to the
Jesus
recoveries,
Christ,
that'd be bad, right?
That'd be a bad thing.
Revolution,
yeah.
Amidst...
Yeah. A revolution, yeah. Amidst healing. Yeah. A revolution against healing.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
You know, I mean, I've been to some rehabs that I got a lot out of that helped. You know, they say that when you go to rehab, if you use after you get out, then it wasn't a successful trip. But I don't look at it that way. The recovery community doesn't look at it that way, because if you go to rehab, you pick something up. No matter what, whether it was your time to get sober or not, you got something out of it that is helping you on your path.
Yeah.
And yeah, there was, you know, for me, the rehab that has been the most... amazing was one that was intensive therapy. And I mean, that one I was nervous all the time because
you tell them everything you've ever wanted to tell anybody,
or kind of, yeah. They make you it's intense, dude.
And you're obviously a communicator, like, so you must have a
lot. Yeah, but I'm a good liar, too.
You must have a lot to say to these people, I'm guessing.
Sure.
Yeah.
But, dude, I'm a good liar. You know, I became a good liar as a kid.
Right.
I lied about my sexuality.
Yeah,
so I got really good at it.
You're right.
You know, you have to be able to fake it so real. It's a Courtney Love line. Fake it so real, you're beyond fake. Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, that was a difficult time. God, we're all over the place. I haven't talked about that one moment in Paris. We'll get into the rehab thing again, but I was there for 6 months and
in Miami.
I had just gotten out of rehab, and I thought, okay, you fucked up. You lost your job at VH1. Big job.
What were you doing at VH1?
I was their music director.
That was a big job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was nice because it was at a time that the station had decided to get away from Michael Bolton Records and start playing Pearl Jam and the Red Hot Chili Peppers. It was kind of a whole different time for VH1.
Yeah, there's more than meets the eye to you, Marco. And I appreciate that because you came in here and I was saying, oh, I know a couple people who know you. And you're like, oh, anybody talk shit? I'm like, no.
Yeah. So I always wonder about the shit talking thing.
That evidently you've had some things in your life that have happened. Everybody loves you. And everybody like
I don't know about that.
That I've ever talked to.
Well, that's God, that's super cool to hear. I can't say that everybody loves me by any means. Although I did have a friend the other day who shall remain nameless, who said something that really meant a lot to me. Because I said to him, thanks for not giving up on me all these years. Like, yeah. You've stayed there all these years. Thank you for not giving up on me. And it was in response to a mutual friend of ours that is not a good dude. And, yeah, whatever. I don't want to get on this track. Anyway, let's get back to Paris.
Yes.
So, it was this genius moment where I was so sick. The reason I wanted to go to Paris, I had this reason in my mind. There's this new song that Tomas from Daft Punk had just put out on his own label. Yeah, yeah. And it wasn't a massive thing, but I knew it was going to be a club hit, right? Yeah. It was called Spinal Scratch. And by Tomas Bangalter, it was just him doing shit outside Daft Punk. Because Daft Punk is a, you know, rigid thing. If dude's in the studio and creating something rad that people are going to react to, he wants to put it out on his label and get
Have
it out.
Have you heard of MonsterFresh.com?
Nope.
A good friend of mine runs it. It's an online zine. He's probably listening right now. I bet you he knows what the guy you're talking about. He knows everything about music.
Yeah, it's so anyway, what's up, Chris? he had released this stuff, and I had just been obsessed with it.
Yeah.
So I had one moment that I wanted, just one moment that I wanted to have in Paris. And it was, I want to be at a club, either, well, Tomas used to DJ at a club called Le Queen. Mm-hmm. And it was like the big gay club in Paris.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, all right, fucking, I can kill two birds with one stone. I can hear the music I want to hear and potentially get laid. Yeah. So I'm going to fucking Le Queen, and I want to be at Le Queen when this song hits, because I know what that dance floor is like. I've been here. I was sick as a dog. So I had blown off all my plans. I didn't go into the studio with air. I didn't do any of these things. The girlfriend I was with did everything. She took off, and I laid in a hotel room watching Parisian TV without subtitles going, I don't understand a fucking thing these shows are saying to me. But I'm miserable laying here in bed. And it was this moment. It was our last day in Paris. And I was like, fuck, I'm going out. And she was already in bed. It was like 3, almost 4 in the morning. And that's not unusual in Paris. You can go out and do that. And
right.
Club Seattle goes till 11 weird, or noon or yeah. whatever. So we have the bottle of wine that comes with the hotel. And I'm like, fuck it, I'm drinking it. I don't care how much it is. Yeah. So I drank the entire bottle of wine, showered, cleaned up. And just was like, I'm going fucking out right
Fuck
now.
Yeah.
And I went to this club, and literally I can remember, other than being in the bathroom stalls with drag queens, which, you know, I mean, at that time, come on, it's, you know, drag queens always have the best coke.
Right.
So
I'll remember that.
Yeah, that's the key. I just remember the song hitting. And first of all, Parisians do not like Americans. Like, I mean, again, that's a blanket statement.
It's pretty obvious.
It's, yeah.
They hear an accent.
Now it's totally different in London. Like London,
they embrace
you
America.
Speak. All I know is that I would go to clubs, and if I saw somebody that was good looking, that I was like, ooh, I would just go talk by them. And
talk
it
in
was,
their general direction.
Yeah, in their general direction. And that way, I actually had a fucking prayer. Like, it was amazing, dude. The fact
they find the American accent sexy?
I think in England, yes. Wow, in Paris, okay. No. Like, it's no. In fact, it's a negative in Paris. And I can just remember going, all right, so, you know, I'm sick anyway. Like, but I just remember that moment when that song hit. And I think I was drinking a $9 beer. That's how much those friggin' things were. Maybe I bought a split of champagne. I can't remember. But when that song came on, I was like, this is it. You're exhausted. You are sick as a dog. But I took that moment, and that's probably what got me sicker, is I was like, fuck this. This is my one moment in Paris. I'm going out. Yeah. I'm going out by myself, and I'm going to dance my ass off when I hear this one song. And I knew it would come on. I just knew. Yeah, and when feeling. It happened, I was like, in heaven, dude. I just remember going, this is it. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And I just ran out on the dance floor and just.
That sounds euphoric.
It was euphoric. Yeah. I mean, that's what music does for me. Yes, you know, at that moment when it's just perfect. Yeah. And I had wished my friend was with me. But she'd been out to dinner with people and like, sure, her plans didn't stop just because I was sick. You know, I would have loved it if she just stayed in the hotel room with me and was miserable, but no, I wouldn't have loved that. But she just did her thing and, she didn't want to go out to that club. She was exhausted. And so I just fucking did it, but it was such a payoff to me being in that club in the middle of the dance floor with my eyes closed, just throwing down hard. It was so much fun.
What's the name of that song again?
Spinal Scratch.
Okay.
By Tomas Bangalter. You gotta look up all his stuff. All his solo stuff is badass, dude. Like the stuff that is not Daft Punk is amazing. You know, and it's not produced as big as Daft Punk, and there's not many vocals, but you know, it was at the same time he was doing Stardust. So it was when Music Sounds Better With You came out, which is one of my all-time favorite songs.
Okay.
That's all him, too. And I just think the guy's a total genius. And it was just that perfect moment for me in
What'd you think of Kanye
Paris.
West's sampling of one of Daft Punk's songs?
I mean, you know, my thing with Kanye
is... Were you
aware
of that song long before?
Oh, yeah. Long before.
Any Daft Punk fan would have been.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, it was massive. I mean, the song was even massive. You didn't have to be...
Oh, right.
Yeah, you didn't have to be a huge fan.
It's not a deep cut.
Nah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm fine with that. I think what Kanye does is I like Kanye's music.
Yeah.
I especially like the last record that everybody...
The most recent one?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Everybody disses, but I really like that production. I like the fact that he attempts to do stuff to change pop culture. I just wish he wasn't such a douche doing it. You know what I mean?
When you say that, like, how do you mean? Like, I'm picturing that for a split second what you mean by that, but how is he attempting to
like,
change
I
pop
just
culture?
Read. Oh, what? That? Oh, with like on music. The last record?
Yeah.
Dude, he went and got some of the most out there dance music production guys and made this hip hop record with. Dance like an underground dance vibe, so it's got this underground electronic vibe to it. Like he went hard in the electronic. That shit is not acceptable to a Kanye West mainstream audience. For him to actually do it,
describing something like Bowie might have done. Didn't Bowie go to like Berlin and do some crazy shit?
Yeah, I mean Kanye dipped into something and to me did it successfully. I've seen a million. Rock artists or hip-hop artists try to delve in another genre and fail miserably. And what I think Kanye did on this record is really well done.
Okay.
Like, I hear some of those producers and I'm like, that shit is sick. Those electronic, like, those sounds behind Kanye's rap. And then his rap brings it all, it commercializes it enough to not just make it a background record. So there's those moments on the Kanye record where if you pull his voice out, that's an out there fucking electronic record, dude. You know, and for him to, he's not going to have massive commercial hits on this. He knew. He knew what he was doing.
I hear Black Skinhead is a good song. Or Brown Skinhead.
Black Skinhead. Yeah.
Is that a good one?
I mean, yes. And, you know, there's, that is a good one. Yeah. I mean, the whole record is good. The way it flows, it's just, it's challenging record for the mainstream. And I appreciate that. Cool. Like, he's forcing this shit into the mainstream that is not mainstream. This is underground culture being forced into the mainstream. And to me, that's pretty punk rock.
It's all about the punk rock.
I mean, isn't it?
Doing your own thing.
Yeah. You know, I just wish that, you know, he would shut the fuck up sometimes.
You know, I like it when...
He just compared himself to Nelson Mandela.
What?
See, his timing.
I don't know what's wrong with me, but none of that shit bothers me. I'm like, oh, well, he's fucking talking shit.
Well, I guess that's, you know, I mean, to a certain extent, a friend of mine says the same thing. I wouldn't like him as much if he didn't talk this much shit. But I think that this has got to be orchestrated because nobody can possibly...
He's aware of what people think of him, so maybe he's pushing the envelope like, oh, yeah.
I think that potentially he's always been aware of this and that it's a... It's a personality thing that he chose to move forward on. Yeah. I don't think he thought he was going to get as much flack as he did for going on stage and stealing the mic from a fucking little girl. But
there was some Kanye quote in an interview or a song lyric, I'm not sure, but it stuck with me for some reason a couple years ago. I read, he said, "You guys want me to be great, but you don't want me to talk about how great I am." Like,
right.
What the fuck? Like, if I'm great and I say it, who gives a shit?
It was something like, if I don't acknowledge I'm a genius, that is so fucking stupid to say, though, dude. I mean, either it's not, and it's just super, super honest.
Yeah.
And maybe it is. It's just still hard to hear from somebody. I don't want somebody to tell me what a genius he is. I want to imagine.
Is modesty overrated?
Maybe it's a new generation, dude. It's the me generation.
I used to play music with a lot of Midwest guys.
Yeah.
And I'm from Florida, and there's clearly a difference. Like, I might be talking some shit, not Kanye shit, but like we'd be in the practice, and I'd be saying something that made myself look good or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And the Midwest showboat band would just be like,
showboat.
It's not fucking cool, man.
Yeah.
It's like, that. And they would have things to brag about, but they would never, ever bring it up.
Right. Oh, totally. It is a Midwest thing. I worked with a friend who was like, yeah, we just, you don't say stuff about, we don't talk about ourselves like that. Right. And I'm like, well, whatever. I did an interview with a magazine or something. She's like, yeah, we just. No, you know what it was? Okay. It was her boyfriend was Prince's DJ. And she has all these amazing stories of her boyfriend, who's a pretty well-known person in this town, being like these fucking killer stories. And I was like, why doesn't he talk about these things on his show? And she's like, oh, we don't do that where we come from. And I'm like, all right.
Where were they from again?
But it's rad here, Minneapolis.
Exactly.
But I love them both. It's just, it's Kevin Cole from KXP. Oh, I mean, that dude was Prince's fucking DJ, and he's got like these stories of like Prince coming in and going, hey, I just recorded this, can you play it in the club? I just want to hear how it sounds in here. Like, fucking killer stories about him and
it's
Prince.
It's funny you say Kevin Cole, because that's the guy when I snuck into McCartney.
Yeah.
When I actually snuck past, I got a wristband somehow, and I snuck past the first wave of security into like down into the main seats, but I think I sit right behind Kevin Cole.
Oh, you did?
And I know who he is.
Yeah.
And so
he's the nicest fucking human being ever.
Girlfriend or wife.
Yeah, Sean.
And they were getting ready to go on a flight, and I told her, I was like, oh, I snuck in, so I'm kind of sweating because if anybody rolls in. And she gave me her ticket when they left. So when those guys were talking shit to me,
yeah,
they're like, you don't even belong here. We saw what you were doing. I'm like, here's my ticket right here, bitches. You know,
that's cool. Sean did that. Good
yes,
for
yes.
Good. Dude, I have to say, the amount of respect I have for you. I mean, this whole conversation's been great. Obviously, you're educated. You know music. But the fact that you waited 2.5 hours in a fucking bathroom stall to sneak into fucking, dude, that is legend. Yeah, that's you. The shit
thank
legends
you,
are made
thank
out
you,
of. That makes me like you so much more.
Listen, we got just about 5 more minutes.
Okay.
I want you to tell me about the glamour and the squalor, where it's at, and what people can expect.
Okay, so we've been working on this movie for about a year. It's a documentary. Well, it started out as a documentary about the Seattle scene, okay, as seen through my eyes, 91 to 97. And now it's turned into a story more about me.
The glamour and the squalor.
Yeah, which was the name of my first radio show ever. And I talk about it. The movie, I don't want to say that I'm nervous about the movie, but I'm a little apprehensive that the vibe of the movie, me and my director get in some pretty intense conversations, and most of the conversations regard what the movie was intended to be in the beginning and what the movie has evolved into. And he is convinced that the story is strong enough without any other fucking stars in there at all. Like,
but just you as the focal.
Just me as the
story.
Yeah. And I'm not so comfortable with that, because it means that I feel a little bit like I'm in a fish tank, and it's a little, I have no filters during this film either. With all the footage
here today, I wouldn't imagine you did there.
No. Well, I talk about way more there.
Oh, okay, good.
I mean, dude, we go back.
Shirley Manson talking about you or something.
Yeah, that was cool. Yeah. We went back to a place in New York that I bottomed out in on the Upper West Side. We went back and revisited the street where I bought drugs, the story, and it was a fucking intense thing for me. Yeah. Although we went at 8 in the morning, which is a good time not to. It makes the street look a lot happier and right, brighter. And
you were there at what, 11 at night, 12 at night?
Yeah, I mean, even walking up, I could have bought drugs instantly. Like, I know, I can just see it. You know what I mean? It's like,
sense that sort of thing.
Yeah, and I could have even scored them at 8 in the morning. But that was, I was nervous to go there because I got into a lot of trouble there. And
Upper West Side, New York.
Yeah, right on Amsterdam,
hang
dude.
Hang out with Michael Stipe?
What?
You know Michael Stipe at all?
No. No,
I'm a huge fan. He hangs out in New York City. Anyway,
yeah, I was supposed to go to his Christmas party when I was in New York and never went.
Jesus, I would love to go.
It was a dumb ass thing. He throws this amazing Christmas party every year, like massive DJs, like
really?
Beautiful. And I got invited, and I fucking didn't go.
Fuck.
Yeah, it was a bad time in my life. I'm not going to say it was a bad time in my life. It was a time in my life that I've learned a lot from.
Yeah.
Didn't
kill you, right?
Almost did.
Made you stronger.
Almost did. I mean, not that if the drugs didn't, the situation I got myself into almost did.
Okay.
Bad situation with some local people. And it just was
were
not.
Were guns involved?
Not directly.
Okay.
But I had the police escort me out of my house because I couldn't leave. And so they escorted me out.
Jesus Christ, Marco.
It was fucking insane, dude. It was a bad, bad time. I mean, I had to abandon the place. I came back to my apartment with a bunch of guys to get my shit out the next day because I thought I was going to be, or a couple days later, I thought I was going to. There was a moment, two people were execution style murdered on my street 2 years before I lived there. And it's predominantly a Puerto Rican and Dominican street.
Yeah.
So it was heavy, dude. And it had changed a lot. You know, it had been gentrified or whatever, but
it was just like money and drug related?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Bad scene. Bad scene. I'm not, you know. Here's the thing with me and drugs. I think drugs, if you can handle them, awesome for you.
Yeah.
Good for fucking you.
And if you can afford them.
It has way less to do with affording them, because I know that I have found ways to get drugs without being able to afford them.
Sure.
And it has more to do with you can live and dabble in drugs recreationally, good for you. I can't fucking do it. I can't do that. So I can't do it at all. Like, if for me, I can't even, I'm just not that guy that can do recreational drugs.
Are you clean-ish now?
Yes.
You are?
Yeah.
No drinking?
Drink. Well, that's a point of contention.
Okay.
Yeah.
With some people, sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Remember that question I was talking about?
Okay. We can end
it. You know what? I try. Here's the thing. I can't drink. I can't. Yeah.
Understood.
But I continually think that I can. And I try. I never had problems with alcohol. But the problem, dude, is that I drink and it makes me instantly want drugs. So I get one beer in me, two beers in me, yeah, or whatever. And then I'm like, fuck it. Like, this little switch in my head goes off, and I'm like, let's go, and let's go hard. And it's...
Well, that's the same thing that led you to go to the dance floor at 4 in the morning to listen to this song, dig up all these 12 inches, and discover all this cool shit. It's the same obsessive thing that leads you to do all these things. So for better or for worse, you have that.
Yeah, except that at one point it's going to kill me if I don't get it completely under wraps.
Yeah.
And... you know, that has been my biggest struggle, is thinking that I could drink. Because I wasn't a blackout drinker. I mean, maybe a couple times in college, but I wasn't. Is your next host coming in?
Oh, no, dude. We're cool.
Okay.
We're cool.
Is there somebody here? Are we the only guys here?
We're the only people here.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, so, cool. You know, for me, that's always been the issue. When I relapse, it's normally on red wine, like a really good red wine, because I miss that shit with dinner. But, you know, the thing is that what happens to me, sometimes I can drink.
Yes.
For a week. 2 weeks.
Yes.
And then inevitably what happens is I want drugs. And I know where to find them.
I grew up around recovery people.
Okay.
My stepdad and everybody that worked for him.
Okay.
So I didn't know it at
it's
the
time. It's an all or nothing thing, dude. And it's kind of a bummer. I do have friends that have been in recovery forever and were able to drink now.
Yeah.
And they don't go do drugs. And fuck them. Because I can't fucking do that. It's not something I've mastered. So
at least you know. You're sitting here telling me right now.
Yeah, dude. Good. It's just rough, though. It's rough. Yeah. It's rough sometimes. Because I feel like I've wasted a lot of fucking time and done a lot of really dumbass shit. But I can't regret where I've been, because I believe that it's making me into somebody that I need to be, whatever that person is, whatever that message is.
Yeah.
You know, with the film, when the guys approached me, it was going to be like, I said to them, how's the film going to end? It's not like I've been sober for fucking 10 years. Like, what's the end of the story? Like, oh, here's this guy that's fucked up a bunch of shit, and yo, he's still fucking around. And so, you know, I guess the story is, I'm probably like a lot of people. Life isn't perfect.
Yes.
Like, you
absolutely
know. So I don't know, dude. I'm a little nervous about the movie. So hopefully The Glamour and the Squalor will be out in 2014. We've had to shut down production right now because we ran out of money. Just being honest, like, making an independent film is way more expensive than we thought it was going to be. So hopefully 2014.
Okay.
And the later the better, as far as I'm concerned.
I feel like talking to you now, how could the movie not be interesting? You know, really?
I mean, it's going to be interesting, dude. I don't want to be a freak show.
Right.
Like, and I'm pretty honest about my life in this movie.
Yeah.
I mean, here's the thing. It's not as intense as it could be. Like, we decided that the movie's bottom was here instead of down here in the gutter.
Okay.
Like, we keep it at a reasonable level.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, I mean, the real story is a little more intense than the movie will display.
Okay.
But, I mean, the thing is that that's not, it's not important. That's not important. What's important is that I'm still alive.
Fuck yeah.
And hopefully I'm learning from my mistakes. And at one point, I hopefully will be happy.
I think positive changes in life often start with saying them And I just heard you say a bunch of really positive shit. So next is the action that follows. And
yeah. Well, I've been in action for a long time. It's just that it's not
the definitive action.
Well, it's not action perfected.
Right.
So, you know, live and learn, dude. Live and learn.
Well, thanks, Mark.
I totally have cotton mouth right now. I'm like, God, it got all intense at the end. I wonder how many people are actually listening. Do you ever know?
You know, I don't know. I think there's a way to find out, but I'll tell you what. I always make a podcast up if you're cool with that. And
sure.
I spread it around. People listen
okay,
to it.
Okay, awesome.
It's great. So.
Yeah.
I appreciate it, man.
Fuck.
And it's been a real pleasure.
It's really cool meeting
nervous.
You, too.
It's always, every time, I'm a little nervous, but then it's fine.
What is your, so I heard you say your name was Jesse earlier in the interview, but your name is Jay?
No, my name's Jesse.
Okay. Jaybo Hippopotamus is your...
J-Bonamus T. Baggins.
Okay, got it.
That's just funny. So one time we were in this band, and my buddy goes, oh, you're J-Bo. I was like, J-Lo.
Okay.
It's Jesse Boggs.
Got it. Name. Okay.
And so that's my only nickname ever that I've kind of liked a little bit. And so I changed it from J-B-O to J-A-Y-B-O.
Okay.
And I think,
do you prefer to go by J-Bo or Jesse?
Jesse.
Okay. Cool.
But people who know me through this will say J-Bo, and that's fine
right.
too. But
okay.
Jesse's fine. That's my name.
Cool. So. Well, this was fun.
Awesome,
this is,
man.
This is cool, and I like what you guys are doing here. I think this is a fucking awesome place. People should definitely support this place.
Hollow Earth Radio.
Yep.
Absolutely. And if you want to get a show, we can get you on the air.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I'm not too much of a commercial fucking DJ for this.
Commercial? With the stories you just told me? I don't know, dude. You fucking...
I guess
come on
not.
Now. All that shit that may have been like hot in the late 90s you're talking about is nobody knows about anymore.
Right.
You could play it and be like, holy shit, this guy.
Right.
Fucking retro.
Rad.
All right, man. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. What are you playing now?
You
hitting this little button here?
Well, I got some, we'll let you pick. Libertines, Metallica, John Lennon Live.
Modest I think Mouse. Libertines might be appropriate.
Okay, cool. They're a great band.
That's what's his name's band, right? Pete Doherty?
Pete Doherty.
Yeah.
There we go. Yeah. Guys, tune in next week. Shit Show with J-Bo. I got just a friend of mine. I think he's going to talk some Beatles shit. I don't know. But he's a good guy.
2 hours in a bathroom stall. Fucking A.
Yeah. Thanks, Marco. Have a wonderful day.
Will do.
All right.